not allowed to eat anything in daytime. Of course, at night, they compensated for the day's fasting, but in full calm and tranquility. Interestingly, most travelers wrote their accounts on Nowruz when the feast coincided with the month of Ramadan or Muharram. Thus, they would witness that people would observe religious rituals and would prefer them to national customs and feasts. Frederick Charles Richards was an American who had traveled to Iran during the rule of Reza Khan Pahlavi. In part of his book on Nowruz, he writes, "Iranians believe in this old tradition that anyone who, before speaking a word, eats something sweet in the morning of Nowruz and oils his body, no bad incident will occur to him. Nearly all people go to bath and put on new clothes." Richards points to Nowruz customs in Isfahan and writes, "When the ceremonies of mourning of Nowruz end, those people of Isfahan who are able rush toward to the river Zayanderu to stay there till afternoon and evening. They have adhered to the custom of narration and reciting of Shahnameh and the story of Rostam and Sohrab, and they are engaged in singing around the historical bridges of Isfahan at the banks of Zayanderu."
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I'm your host, Zainab. The listeners, we have been discussing about the duties of waiters of Imam Mahdi, ajallaha ta'ala faraja, in which we categorized some of the most important duties. And we were with Dr. Ali Alawi, who categorized the duties as the first one was marifat of imam, or the knowledge of imam, and then knowing the status of imam, then relying on the rope of wilaya or guardianship, then waiting for reappearance, and then we discussed social reform or self-reform, in which we were discussing about media readiness and military readiness. Dr. Alawi, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome. Thank you for once again accepting the invitation.
Thanks for inviting me to this show. It's a great pleasure for me to be here.
Same here. It's a pleasure to be with you, sir. What are my duties as a Shia, as a believer, towards my imam, towards the imam of my time? And Dr. Alawi, I would want you to tell further duties.
Yeah. I want to take a permission to actually continue with the love of
love
Imam alayhi salam,
affection.
Because this topic was left incomplete. I want to shed some more light
here.
In that issue. In another hadith, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, the 11th Imam, says towards his son, that is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, "Ya bunayya, wa'alam anna quluba ahl al-ta'a wal-ikhlas nuzza'un ilayka mithla al-tayri idha ammat awkaraha." That is, "The hearts of the people of servitude and worship fly towards you like a pigeon, like a bird flies towards its nest." Imam alayhi salam is the center of receiving all these loves and affection from different people of servitude and worship.
True.
Not ordinary people. People who are, actually, as I said earlier, those who work on themselves.
True,
those
true.
Who work in the society level or social level.
Who have gone
these are the people of servitude and purification. their hearts actually flies towards you as
like
a
bird
flies towards its nest.
Yeah.
You see? So he is that center which is receiving the attention of the people and the love of the people and, let's say, the servants of God and the scene of the earth. But again, like the remembrance of Imam, if you remember, we said at the time that we have been talking about one of the duties of the waiters is to remember Imam.
True.
We said that this remembrance is not one-sided. It's two-sided. It's bilateral.
It's two-sided bilateral.
Even Imam says, إِنَّا غَيْرُ مُهْمِلِينَ لِمُرَاعَاتِكَ. That is, it's not that something that we forget you. We are also remembering you.
True.
This love also is, again, a bisided, let's say, a two-sided love.
Wow.
And Imam also cares for the servants of God, for the followers of the Imam and for the lovers of him. And he is happy at the time that they are happy and he is sad at the time that they are sad.
They are sad.
Yeah, this is again among in an hadith by Imam Ridha alayhi salam that says, Al-Imamu al-Anis al-Rafiq wal-Walid al-Shafiq wal-Akhu al-Shaqiq wal-Ummu al-Barrah bil-Walad al-Saghir. That is, Imam is a trustworthy and a friendly person and a brother and a compassionate. And it's like a mother who is kind to her young children.
Yeah.
So this is the status of Imam. That is, Imam cares for the old people. Sometimes it is being said that Imam is even kinder than the mother and the father of a person. Even some poems in Farsi, they say usually, and because they are actually a translation of these hadith, that they say that you are even kinder than my mom to me.
Yeah.
You see, how is it possible that Imam is that kind? Because they are actually manifestation of Asma. Names and, let's say, attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala cares for his creatures, for his servants, then Imam, who is a symbol of Allah's names and attributes, then he actually acts the same.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. This long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
We said that he is happy with the happiness of his servants and he is sad with the sadness of the servants. The same continuing about the bilateral relation in the case of love of Imam.
Yeah.
Imam alayhi salam says that Imam, as a person that he talks about himself, he says, "Ana anna la nafrahu la farahukum wa nahzunu la huznukum." That is, when you're happy, you're happy. When you're sad, you're sad. This is the status of an Imam. You see, we rejoice in your joy and we grieve in your sorrows.
Yeah.
This is what Imam actually looks like. Then Imam Ridha alayhi salam in another hadith says, مَا مَنْ أَحَدٍ مِنْ شِعَتَنَا يَمْرَضُ إِلَّا مَرِضْنَا لِمَرَضِهِ وَلَا اغْتَمَّ إِلَّا اغْتَمَمْنَا لِغَمِّهِ وَلَا يَفْرَحُ إِلَّا فَرِحْنَا لِفَرَحِهِ وَلَا يَغِيبُ عَنَّا أَحَدٍ مِنْ شِعَتَنَا أَيْنَ كَانَ فِي شَرْقِ الْأَرْضِ أَوْ غَرْبِهَا. The same that Imam Ali alayhi salam was actually explaining, that said that we rejoice with your happiness and with your joys and ecstasies.
Yeah.
Imam says, and even one of you becomes sick, we become sick. If one of you is happy, we become happy. It doesn't matter if you are in the west of the earth or the east of the earth.
East of the earth.
So it doesn't matter where you are located.
Even if you're poles apart.
Yeah. So this Imam we are talking about, we are waiting for such an Imam who is going to come, inshallah, spread justice.
And how should we not remember such Imam? Such
very true. And not to love him.
Yeah. And as you said, one of the points here, that this love and this remembrance is bilateral. This has been proved for me. Like, I knew very much less about the Imam of the time, but at the same time, I wanted to know about Imam without referring to hundreds of libraries or without consuming more time into the libraries and books. But I wanted to know more and more and more about Imam. And I'm so lucky to be listening to you here, and listeners in the same way are very, very lucky to listen this session and learn so much about Imam. This 15-minute session is giving us information of hundreds of libraries, hundreds of sources, and this proves in itself the bilateral relationship with Imam.
We are talking still about the love of Imam, yeah, as a duty of the waiter of the Imam to love Imam. And we have been talking about this love from the tongue of and from the wording of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Imam Ridha. And now let's listen from the person that we are talking about, that is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Look what is the way that he loves his own people and his own nation. Imam says, in a hadith says, I became aware of the doubts of a group of you Shias and the followers of Ahlul Bayt about their religion, and the doubts and confusions about the governors. So this is our sorrow for you, not for ourselves. And we were affected for you, not for ourselves. That is, if I become sorrowful, it's not because of me myself. This is what I'm actually, I feel sorrow for what has come to you. That is, your governors, for example, I don't know, oppressed you or mistreated you or whatever happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, you see, he says that what I'm sad for, it's
you,
because of you, not because of me myself.
Well.
You see, this is the Imam that we are talking about, and he will, inshallah, come and will save the world.
That's so beautiful. That's so such a nice relation. You reminded me of this poem that says that you want to shed tears. The affection and love between you and me is so much that you feel like crying, but tears shed from my eyes.
Mm.
You feel like smiling, but the smile comes on my face. So it completely takes me back to Imam, like the way you said that you feel sorrowful, you feel sad, but I become sorrowful.
Mm.
So yeah, that's the love of Imam, and that's so beautiful.
Hold me by your hand and please show me the way to be one of the pure and chosen companions, so that I can swear the oath of allegiance. I'll give everything that I love in God's name to avenge the blood of your grandfather Hussein. Every step of the way, my dream will come true. On my last breath, oh Master, I'll call out to you. O light of Allah, you are my true guide. I'm waiting for you to die by your side.
The next duty among the duties of the waiters of the Imam alayhi salam, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is the grief at the parting of the Imam. That is, grief because of being far from Imam alayhi salam, being distant from Imam. Look, we talked about remembering Imam, loving Imam,
love and affection,
and then grief for being distant and being far from Imam. It has been introduced as a duty of, let's say, waiter of the Imam at the time of his occultation.
Without making any efforts.
Yeah.
Just being emotionally attached to Imam.
Very
you
true.
Can do all
so we need
three
to
duties.
Have this sort of, let's say, hopelessness.
Yeah.
That we are only waiting for you to come.
Yeah.
When you love somebody, when you remember somebody, when you know that you love him and he is a beloved, then you have to show this love through a grief.
It should look.
Definitely, for our, let's say, for material life. For example, when we see that the person that we love, for example, our wives or, I don't know, our husbands, then we have to show this sort of, let's say, being distant from each other. We have to show this grief in some way or other.
True.
So the same goes to the Imam, the person that we are waiting with, because this level of love is even higher than the material love.
True.
Because true love is firstly actually a sort of a spiritual love.
True.
Look, the beauty and let's say the taste which exists in the spiritual love cannot be even be
cannot
described and cannot be sensed except
love.
A person experiences it.
Yeah.
Let me at a point here, once it was narrated from Ayatollah Bahjat Rahmatullah Ali, that he said, the kind of juice that I taste while I'm in a state of prostration cannot be sensed and found anywhere else. So he's not exaggerating when he's talking about that. Look, the kind of rejoice and let's say joy and ecstasy that I am
enjoying
while I'm in a state of prostration cannot be sensed and found anywhere else.
Wow.
So you see, even in the material level of that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is our duty again, to be in a state of grief for Imam alayhi salam. Yeah. And it has been taught to us, and it has been recommended to us. How? In the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. How, again? If we don't have time, I can leave it for another session to work on it. But just to introduce, when Imam alayhi salam talked about that, when one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, so they say Rafi, went to Imam, and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was crying and weeping. On what? Mm-hmm. On being distant and a state of grief for being far from Mahdi alayhi salam.
Oh.
Who has not yet been born.
Who is not born
so
yet.
So this is, again, we see based on the attitude and based on the, behavior of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we learn that this has to be a duty of us at the time of his occultation to be like that.
So it has been actually the entire list of duties we went through. And in the light of narrations and in the light of verses, how easy have these duties been made for us? It's
very
so
true.
Easy. And then... it's very unfortunate that even if we know these narrations and these duties and we are still not acting on them, it's really unfortunate. So yeah, when you're loving someone and that person is far away from you, it should show up.
Exactly.
It should show up on your face or like whenever you're very, very happy in this material life, there should be some corner where there should be some missingness in your life.
Very beautiful.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alevi, for being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for giving such beautiful list of duties and making it clear for us, making it easy for us, especially in the light of narrations and verses. Thank you once again. Thank you, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value. In that it would show that the church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against the First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words? Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen. The demonstrators marked the seventh anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom.
The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least 8 people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realized that they are on the losing side of the war, one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel, Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength. Since the beginning of the war, they are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen has announced a 3-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Meshaat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Meshaat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdel Salam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them, but instead it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, one that the U.S. and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, The Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up. But it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
آقایی بود به نام یوسف ابن یعقوب. ایشون مسیحی بود.
A Christian man by the name of Yusuf ibn Ya'qub was one of the politicians at the time of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Once Mutawakkil al-Abbasi commanded him to go to his court. He was frightened since he knew that if Mutawakkil invites someone to his court, he will be either executed or tortured. He prepared himself to go to Samarra to visit Mutawakkil's court. He promised to himself that if he is saved from the punishment of Mutawakkil, he will give 100 dinars in charity. When he reached Samarra, out of his fear, he decided to give 100 dinars in charity to the house of Imam al-Hadi before going to the court. He was a Christian, but he heard that the mercy of the Shiite Imams showers all humans. However, he didn't know that where the house of Imam al-Hadi was. He was also fearful, so he couldn't ask anyone the address of the house.
همینطور که هاجواج مانده بودم میگه مرکبم یه در یه خونه ایستاد.
He was shocked and didn't know what to do when suddenly his horse stopped by a door and never moved again. Then the door of the house was open and a man came to him. The man called him by his name, Yusuf ibn Ya'qub, and welcomed him. On that time, Yusuf ibn Ya'qub understood that the Shiite Imams have the knowledge about the unseen, and by the grace of Allah, they can be informed about the news of the world too. He became very much happy and gave the Imam 100 dinars in charity so that the Imam pray for his freedom from the court of Mutawakkil. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic Lights Out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abach Archaeological Park was occupied for 1700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abach is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even minor spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glassy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year, we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around $14 to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
I mean,
the discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in the right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others. A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material such as oil paints to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the US 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as sea shells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs.
IRIB English Radio.